Today, the 22nd of March, is World Water Day. And we're going to spend a few minutes on World Water Day talking about something that many of us have heard about and yet don't probably know very much about. It is the Clean Water Act, which became the law of the land half a century ago. And we are going to be talking about sort of the work which that accomplished, the good that that accomplished, but also sort of the unrealized potential of the Clean Water Act. And we're going to be doing that with Eric Schaefer, who is Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project. And he has done extensive work on this and related environmental matters. He has been the executive director of the organization since its founding in 2002. He, in the past, was in the EPA's Office of Civil Enforcement and has also worked as an environmental attorney with a couple of different law firms. So he is well acquainted with some of these issues on a level that most of us are not. Eric Schaefer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, sir. It's my pleasure.
Before we talk about the Clean Water Act, tell us a little bit more about this organization which you helped create back in 2002. What is its central purpose?
I came out of the enforcement program at EPA, which I left now about 20 years ago, and I had always thought there should be more attention to enforcement from public interest groups who mainly focus on making the laws better and trying to get regulations in place. But there's always the question after you get those standards set up of whether people are actually following them. And we have a lot of persistent non-compliance by some very big companies, and I just had an interest in, when I got to the outside, working on those issues, both trying to, you know, push EPA and state agencies to do more enforcement, but also doing some of that from our organization. Hmm.
I suppose in some respects, this is kind of the underbelly of some of these concerns and issues that, I mean, not that it's exactly simple to pass laws and regulations, but there is, in a sense, a clarity about that. But then there is this other piece of it, which is not so easily captured in headlines, which tends not to be paid attention to by the media and others. And so I guess you are interested now in that underbelly and trying to safeguard the purpose and the potential behind things like the Clean Water Act.
That's actually, I don't think I could put it better myself. I did hear a veteran EPA manager say, you know, these laws aren't self-sustaining. It takes a lot of work to actually get them, you know, to move forward through standard setting, which the laws generally give the agencies to do, and just by monitoring compliance and making sure people are doing what they're supposed to do. And of course, a lot of companies do that, but there's this constant pressure to cut corners and backslide, and that needs attention 24/7.
So let's turn our attention to this landmark legislation that was passed half a century ago by the United States Congress, the Clean Water Act. First of all, describe briefly kind of the landscape within which this Clean Water Act passed. This came at a time, of course, when a lot of breakthrough environmental legislation was being crafted and where there seemed to be a dramatically heightened attention to matters related to the environment. What was going on in 1972 that prompted this?
The problems were piling up and getting harder and harder to ignore. That's partly what generated Earth Day in 1970. That was the first Earth Day, drawing huge crowds all over the country, demanding more attention to the environment. And the state of our rivers and streams and lakes was a big part of that anxiety. You might have to be as old as I am to remember how bad it was back in the late 60s. I was a teenager in suburban Virginia, and at least in the summer, you could smell the Potomac River all the time. And when the White House had foreign visitors over, the White House had to shut all the doors and windows to keep the stench out of the president's house. We had rivers catch on fire. People used to say that Cahoga River in Ohio didn't flow. It oozed. It had so much crud in it. And a lot of that was oil and grease, and the river caught fire more than once. And then you had the Fox River in Wisconsin, which would turn white with the waste from paper mills. So the Clean Water Act tackled those problems, and it did make a big difference. Now, say something about how far we have to go, but it required EPA to set some minimum standards for all industries to limit their discharges, which the agency did, spurred by a lot of litigation, but never mind, they did get those initial standards in place. And we put a lot of money, billions and billions of dollars, into improving sewage treatment plants. And those made a difference. You can canoe down the Cahoga River now. That's the one that caught fire. And the Potomac is a major bass fishery. And when I was a kid, all we saw was fish, floating belly up in the river. So you can move forward, and the law really helped us to do that. But we also have a long way to go. Hmm.
Well, that is the reason why we are having this conversation. For those of you just joining us on this World Water Day, we are spending a few minutes with Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project. And one of the things that this organization is doing is taking a very close look at the Clean Water Act passed 50 years ago and trying to assess its efficacy and some of the ways in which it has fallen short of some of its really lofty goals. As a matter of fact, the Environmental Integrity Project has crafted a lengthy, detailed report which lays out its findings in amazing detail. Give us briefly an idea of how you went about doing this study. I mean, it is, by all appearances, an exhaustive study and could not have been a small, simple matter to do.
It took a long time, the better part of a year, to pull the data together. Maybe I can start just by explaining one of the most important parts of the law. And those are the provisions that require Wisconsin and other states to evaluate the condition of rivers, streams, and lakes and determine whether they're safe for swimming. And by swimming, we really mean any water contact by the public, or whether they're healthy enough to support fish and other aquatic life. And there are some other standards that go with that, but let's focus on those two. Those are the two biggest goals that the states have and that the Clean Water Act set, which is make the water safe for people, make it healthy enough to support aquatic life. So states look at their waters, try to decide if they're hitting those marks. Based on the latest round of reviews, about half of the river and stream miles that were studied by states, 700,000 miles out of the 1.4 million miles that were surveyed, don't meet those standards. That means they're either unsafe for swimming or not healthy enough to support aquatic life. So that's half of the river mileage that got analyzed. And we don't even know what the conditions are in another 3.5 million miles of rivers. The states didn't have the funding to analyze those. Wisconsin, for example, evaluated something like 30% of the waterways in the state, a little less than 30% of the rivers in the state. So we've got parts of the system where we don't have any information, but where we do, we see that about half the rivers and streams are impaired. More than 11 million lake acres also fall short. When I say they're impaired, that's the term the states and the federal government use. That just is another way of saying they're too polluted.
I know that part of your report examines state by state the miles that of rivers assessed, and then of those miles assessed, how many miles remain impaired and fall short of the standards of the Clean Water Act. Just sketch for our listeners where we see the most sort of serious shortfalls and to what you attribute that. I mean, are we talking about particular states where for whatever reason they were especially inattentive to the Clean Water Act, or are there other things going on here that would explain why there is a lack of success in certain places?
Okay. Those are important questions. So maybe let me give a little bit of data for Wisconsin. The state has more than 9,000 miles of impaired rivers and streams. And that's about the middle of the pack if you're looking at mileage and trying to see how Wisconsin's doing relative to other states. So, but either way you slice it, that's a lot of work to be done. And one of the problems is, again, the state hasn't assessed more than 70% of its river and stream mileage. So we're in the dark about the condition of those. So 9,000 river and stream miles impaired, that's mostly because they don't really support aquatic life. You have more than 5,000 acres of lakes that are impaired. And that is a very high number. Mostly that's because they're rated unswimmable. And that's mostly because they're full of algae and weeds. So they're just, it's not water you want to get into. So more than 418,000 acres, about 70% of the lake acres that the state looked at, are impaired for swimming and other forms of water contact. That's a lot. That's actually, you have a lot of lakes in Wisconsin, obviously, a lot more than we do in Maryland, so you got to start with that understanding. But if you're looking at the sort of area of impairments for lakes, Wisconsin is third highest in the U.S.
Interesting.
The big problems tend to be phosphorus, nitrogen. So they're so-called nutrients that run off farm fields, can be discharged from sewage plants and industrial factories as well, and an awful lot of it comes from agricultural runoff. When that gets in the water, you get a lot of algae, and the oxygen levels in the water will start sinking, and that, of course, is bad for fish and the other critters.
We should mention that there are other states in the country that have assessed even less than Wisconsin. I mean, I don't remember.
No, that's right.
I know you mentioned a couple of states where their assessment has been of maybe 3% or 5% of their waterways, and of course that is really dismaying, because one can only imagine if that inattentiveness extends in other ways as well, and what one would find if more widespread assessment was done.
You're making an excellent point. The more you look, the more you'll find. That's just how it works in the environmental world. The pollution doesn't jump out at you always. You have to get out and do the assessments to determine whether the waters can support recreation or going to be healthy enough for fish. And Wisconsin is doing more to do those assessments than a number of other states, and that's an important point.
Before we get to your recommendations, it's interesting as we read the report that more than once we see references made to the lofty goals of the Clean Water Act. And there's a couple of ways to interpret that. And, of course, an environmentalist would say, absolutely, they were lofty goals and they should be lofty. I mean, when it comes to the environment, we should set the highest goals we possibly can. And someone else with a slightly different mindset would say, sometimes lofty goals are unrealistic goals. We set goals that are so lofty that we couldn't possibly meet those goals, that they maybe were made naively or carelessly or with unbounded optimism, and that perhaps the goals from the start should have been crafted a bit more realistically. How would you respond to somebody with that kind of concern about the original goals of the Clean Water Act?
So those goals were by 1983 to have all waters clean enough to be swimmable and fishable by 1983. By 1985, to stop the discharge of all pollutants into navigable waterways. So, yeah, it's fair to say that was dreaming big and that was optimistic. Certainly the dates were optimistic. But if you think about how people relate to water that they fish in and swim in, drink, you know, the goals themselves are the right ones. I mean, we do want our waters to be fishable and swimmable, don't we? I mean, we don't want them to be sewers or just, you know, liquid channels that ships can navigate. We do have the in our hearts, we all want waters to get to those conditions. So I think it's okay to have, I think it's good actually to put those marks in front of us and say that's where we want to end up. But yes, I think interim goals that say, okay, that's where we want to be, that's the finish line. We certainly were never going to make it by the 1980s. But can we mark our progress? Can we get better, you know, over a, you know, extended period of time? Can we get closer and closer to that finish line? And I think setting some of those targets in a way that we haven't done very well would be a really good thing.
What would be some of your other recommendations in terms of closing the gap between the goals of the Clean Water Act and where we are right now? What are the goals that your organization suggests or recommendations?
Well, one of the first things we could do is set some standard ways to measure nitrogen and phosphorus, and particularly this problem, and it's a fancy word, it's called eutrophication, but it basically means usually those pollutants, nitrogen and phosphorus, and several others are causing rivers to develop way too much algae, too much weed growth, and are depressing oxygen levels. So those are very important pollutants to limit to keep waters healthy. We could measure those pollutants in standard ways across the U.S. We have a lot of, we have a little bit of a Tower of Babel when you try to look at how well we're doing from one area to the next. And Wisconsin, for example, is part of the Upper Mississippi watershed. So really, it's a multi-state challenge. And, you know, you have groups like the National Academy of Sciences saying years ago that you need to develop a common set of measures for these big watersheds. So that would be a really good thing. We really have to, frankly, just confront honestly and without a lot of double talk, the fact that agricultural pollution is our biggest issue across the U.S. when it comes to water quality. That's something EPA has said. That's something states have agreed with. Wisconsin's been a little less clear on that, but they say the biggest problem now is non-point pollution. Some of that is urban runoff from city streets, but an awful lot of it is agriculture. And we have now something we had a lot less of in 1972. That's a very industrialized form of agriculture where you are using lots and lots of fertilizer, but also in raising livestock, concentrating more and more animals on smaller patches of land in operations that generate just mountains of manure. There's just not enough room to absorb that manure on the surrounding cropland as fertilizer. So you get all this extra manure, and that gets driven into waters and makes them unswimmable and makes them unhealthy for aquatic life. We need better enforcement. Enforcement is slipping. I'm talking now about, it's not that enforcement is the answer to all problems, but we do have a lot of big sources that seem to be violating permit limits year after year, and really not much happens. And they need to understand they can't continue to do that. And the last thing I'll just mention quickly is, I mentioned that EPA set minimum standards for limiting the amount of pollution that big industries could dump in the water, and those definitely did some good. But they are way out of date, and they need to be tuned up to reflect what the best treatment technologies can do. The Clean Water Act actually requires that, but EPA hasn't kept up, and we need to fix that problem.
Eric Schaefer is Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project, and can the public view your full report on your website?
Yes, sir, environmentalintegrity.org.
Very good.
Environmentalintegrity.org, and then the report will be posted right up there for you to see.
Very good. Eric Schaefer, thank you for your good work, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. It was great to speak with you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.